MechCast, Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I missed you. Yeah, it's been a little while. And, just things have been crazy. It's the holidays, right? Things are happening. I decided to take a little bit of extra time to get this episode out just because of the craziness and wanted a little relaxation, right? We all need to get a little break once in a while. So hopefully you don't mind. Hopefully you hung in there. And I am glad, so, so glad you are back here with me. It is the holiday season, and there is quite a bit happening with Apple and stuff around this time of year. Specifically, we have a new Mac to talk about, and one that, costs more than maybe a small vehicle or maybe even a large vehicle. We're going to get into the new Mac Pro and what that's all about. Apple updated a bunch of the OSs. We'll talk about some of the features and enhancements there. Talk a little bit about AirPods and what iPhones might look like in 2020. Possibly some new display technology coming into play. Talk about how Apple might start releasing iPhones in 2020. 21. Is your iPhone tracking you? Yeah, there's a little controversy that happened over the last week or so. Also, Apple getting some awards and giving some awards. We'll get into that. And they also are getting into some new materials for future devices. So we'll get into all of that in the news. And then I have a lot of great feedback and other information to share with you. We're going to dig back into Mac OS installers, those old installers. Yeah, we keep learning more things about how we can get our hands on those. It's tricky, but there's a lot of different ways, and I got some great feedback from you that I am going to share. Also, we have some great questions, one about optimizing your external storage, another one about, or just a comment really that I want to talk to you about privacy on iOS 13, something that's been bothering me and bothering you because I got a couple of emails this week. And then finally, we'll talk about accessing deleted messages and how you might be able to do that. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So glad to have you back here with me. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor. And, you know, we're getting toward the end of the year, maybe the start of a new year, and maybe one of the things you want to do is set up a new server. And a great way to do that would be to use Linode, because they give you a ton of choice and flexibility with their Linode cloud. They allow you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud, and you can get that server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution and resources, and also your choice of 10 different node locations. Best of all, they give all new MacCast customers a $20 credit to get you started. So no matter what you want to do, maybe you want to set up a new blog, WordPress server, they got you covered. Maybe you want to do something a little more fun, a gaming server, Minecraft, Ark, Terraria. You can set that up on your Linode. Or maybe it's more business oriented. You need OpenVPN to secure your network. Or maybe you want to set up GitLab so you can do some programming and set up a code repository. Yep, you can do all of that simply and easily on Linode. Plus, you get your choice of Linux distribution. If it runs on Linux, it will run on Linode. Basically, you can build whatever server you want, and they do feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. So you're going to get the storage, speed, and performance that you want as well. And again, they offer 10 different locations for data centers, so you can pick that, and they just opened a new one in Toronto, Canada. Pricing is also simple with no surprise fees, and you pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. You can get what you need and get started for just $5 a month with a Nanode plan, and you can scale all the way up to high-powered dedicated CPU plans. They make it super easy to do that because they have a dashboard that is amazing. It lets you manage your Linodes and do all of your upgrades. You can even add on things like backup, large storage volumes, and load balancing. And finally, if you need support, they have great 24/7 live customer support along with a large documentation library to help you out. It is a great resource if you get stuck. I had to use it a couple times, and I know. So visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit when you use the promo code MACCAST2019. That's linode.com, linode.com/MACCAST, and your $20 credit with the code MACCAST2019. And a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the MACCAST. Apple made it in under the wire with the Mac Pro. It is now here. It is available for order. It actually came available for order on December 10th. And boy, can you spend some money on that thing. It can cost as much as a luxury car. And I am not kidding. Well, if you max it out, if you tweak it up to 11, you can get it in a price range that, frankly, between you and me, is insane. And no mere mortal person is going to pay for that. That's really for the elite, probably the folks out in Hollywood that need render farms and those sorts of things. And my guess is they're going to be buying these in droves because they are screamers. It is available to order today. It will take a little while for it to get to you because they still need to build it and assemble it. But at least that happens here in the U.S., in their factory in Texas. Now, there is a more reasonable starting price at $5,999 US. That is still a pretty penny, but you do get a lot of system for that. That'll net you a system with a 3.5 gigahertz Xeon W processor, 8-core processor with 32 gigabytes of RAM, a Radeon Pro 580X card with 8 gigs of RAM, and this is my only disappointment with this configuration, a paltry 256 gigabyte SSD. I think a terabyte is the minimum there, but that is going to drive your price up. Now, if you want to talk about really driving your price up, though, how is $52,000? Yes, $52,000. For a Mac. We have reached this point. I thought it was bad back in the day when the 2FX cost about $11,000. But nope, we've reached a new pinnacle in 2019. Now that'll get you a lot of system, a 2.5 gigahertz 28 core Intel Xeon W processor. That turbo boosts up to 4.4 gigahertz. You get 1.5 terabytes of memory. That's 12 128 gigabyte modules, DDR4 error correcting memory, 4 terabytes of storage. They don't have the 8 terabytes yet. That is coming later, but it is coming. Also, 2 Radeon Pro Vega 2 Duo graphics cards, each with 32 gigabytes of memory. The Apple Afterburner card and stainless steel frame with wheels, $400 wheels. I think that's what I pay for wheels on my car. But if you want the wheel option, not the legs, that's going to cost you an extra $400. Yep, we're not kidding, folks. You can't make this stuff up. And, oh, guess what? If you want to add that Apple Pro XDR display along with its $1,000 stand, that's going to kick your price up to over $60,000. Yep, $60,000. All you can do is laugh because it's absolutely crazy. And you may be thinking to yourself, who is going to buy that? I think we already know, and definitely these things are going to sell. It is going to be a status symbol. It is going to be something either elite users use or, again, big time in industry. I would imagine science firms, 3D modelers, film industry, obviously. I don't know that it's going to go into some of the other places like audio. Maybe. I mean, you're going to see them around. But Apple's not going to sell these through the roof like they would, say, this 16-inch MacBook Pro, at least not in these configurations, right? The base configuration, maybe with some tweaks, somewhere in that $6,000 to $10,000 range, I think they're going to be selling a lot of Mac Pros at that level to a lot of different people, especially music industry, film industry, you know, 3D renderers, anybody who needs that kind of raw performance. They're going to be very interested in this machine. So it's exciting. We have a new Mac Pro. It's getting really good early reviews and praise, but it's important to remember that a lot of the stuff we're seeing right now is machines that were given to folks by Apple to review. These are sort of the Apple-blessed reviewers, and I take all of their reviews generally with a grain of salt. They're definitely industry leaders, people that you probably can trust, but you have to remember where they're coming from, right? They're not buying these systems. Apple is giving them to them. So I like to wait on stuff like this till we start to hear reviews from the folks that are actually plunking down the 6K, the 8K for that machine, and see what they think about it, especially after running it through its paces in their industry for a few weeks. I kind of have no doubt that the system is going to continue to get great praise, even in that situation, just based on the specs. And it certainly has its place in the market, and it's exciting to see Apple back in here, and exciting to see people really excited about the Mac Pro. For the longest time, it was sort of languishing, and I think Apple really does, with this version, have a platform for the future, and I hope they plan to keep updating it and keep it fresh and keep it up to date and not let it get stale like they did the trash can Mac Pro. I'd hate to see them move to that cycle where it's again 5, 6, 7 years between models. That should never happen again. And I think with this new Mac Pro, it won't. So that's exciting. A few other odds and ends that we've learned since the release, specifically with the higher end Pro Display XDR, the one with the nano textured glass. A little bit of warning, you need to be careful how you clean that model. As a matter of fact, Apple says in their support documentation that you should only clean the glass on that display with the special dry polishing cloth that they provide with the monitor. You want to use no waters, no liquids on the glass whatsoever, just that cloth, according to Apple. And if you need a new one, you have to contact them to get one. Now, you can wash the polishing cloth. Apple says you can use a little bit of dish soap and water, rinse it thoroughly, and then let it dry for at least 24 hours before using it again. So an entire special cleaning cloth just for that display. Makes you wonder about that surface, you know, how delicate it might be, and how long is it going to last. That'll be interesting to watch, I think. But the other version of the display, the Pro Display, you're fine. You can clean it normally with a microfiber cloth like you usually would. You can even use a little bit of water on that one just fine. It's specifically the nano-textured glass one that you can't do that with. But once again, good to see this in the market, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about it as more folks get their hands on them. Apple pushed out updates for all of the iOS things. iPad OS and iOS 13.3 was released. A couple of the new features in there that are interesting: a communication limit for screen time, meaning that you can control when your kids or maybe even yourself have access to, say, messaging apps or messages. You can also limit it when you are in downtime mode only, and allow messages through when you're not. So a little bit more control over your messaging. They also added a new feature that lets you disable Memoji and Animoji stickers from always appearing in the Emoji keyboard. I guess some folks don't like that. I actually kind of like that feature, but that's where they appear, I think, over kind of on the left side of the keyboard. You can now just go in and disable that. And they finally, thank goodness, finally, because I use these at my office, added support for FIDO2 security keys, things like YubiKeys for two-factor authentication. So that'll be great for a lot of people who use their Macs at their business and just other folks who like to use it for a little bit more security. And then they also, of course, had more bug fixes and other improvements. tvOS 13.3 was also released. The big thing there is you can now choose if you want the top shelf on the main screen to show you up next information versus the what to watch. Apple made that change where they kind of took over that up next area and made it what they called what to watch. And for a lot of us, myself included, I don't really like that. I prefer to have the things that I put in my up next list or the things that I'm watching up there. So I will definitely be changing this setting on my Apple TV. WatchOS 6.1.1 was also released. It brings performance improvements and bug fixes. That's all they put in there. We didn't note any significant new features. If you come across something, let us know about it because I didn't see anything in there. And then HomePod OS was updated to 13.3. It improves family member voice recognition and also fixes an issue that could prevent music playback from resuming on a stereo pair of HomePods after a phone call. The iOS updates and tvOS, watchOS updates weren't the only ones to be released. Apple also did release an update for macOS Catalina 15.2. It includes a new layout for Apple News Plus, stock improvements, photo and mail bug fixes, music bug fixes, and adds support for using an iPhone to remotely control music and TV apps on your Mac. So you can use your iPhone as a remote to control music and TV on your Mac. So that's pretty cool. I haven't had a chance to play around with that, but I have a feeling that will be a very popular feature in, say, dorm rooms where you might be using a Mac as your television as well. So some new software updates out this week. Of course, you can grab all those through your standard software update channels on your Mac and iOS devices. Here's a rumor that when you first hear it, you go, nope, fake, fake, fake. There's no way this is happening. But as you think about it a little bit more, you think, maybe, or at least I did. I'd love to get your opinion on this, but we are hearing reports from DigiTimes, again, take this with a grain of salt, that Apple may bundle AirPods with the iPhone in 2020. And I would assume they would mean the iPhone Pro, probably not the lower priced iPhone, but they have been citing unnamed industry sources that say this is being talked about or at least thought about and might actually happen. Of course, the argument against Apple doing this is the price of AirPods, which start at $160 US. So these are not, you know, the $29 EarPods that Apple typically would bundle with an iPhone. And also the fact that Apple's not really having trouble selling AirPods. So why would they really need to give them away? And that is kind of the immediate place my mind went to, was like, that's crazy. You know, they don't need to give AirPods in an iPhone box because people are going to buy them anyway, right? They're going to buy the iPhone and they're going to buy the AirPods. So why would they do that? And as I thought more about it, I thought, you know, the arguments for could be that, one, they could bundle them into the Pro models, justifying the higher price point. I mean, you've got iPhone Pros at, you know, $1,200, $1,300. So they are not cheap in and of themselves, and it could be a way to justify and continue to justify that high cost as the market gets a little bit more competitive for premium phones. You also have the fact that it gets a lot more AirPods into the market, and Apple does now have the AirPods Pro, so they could get a halo effect of people getting the AirPods in the box, the freebies, and then wanting the next level ones and going for the higher price point. And also, just having more AirPods in the market creates more demand. As more people see other people using them, it just creates this halo effect where everybody's going, oh, everybody has AirPods. Maybe I should look into getting AirPods. And so folks on other platforms, say Android, something like that, it could have this halo effect of pulling in more customers. So I could see it possibly happening. Will it happen? I don't give it a lot of chance, but it would be awesome if Apple did, right? That would be really, really cool. So maybe your next iPhone will come with a set of AirPods. And further evidence that AirPods are selling very, very well and Apple may not need to give them away is a report from the Nikkei Asian Review. They're saying that Apple has asked their supplier Luxshare Precision to double production of AirPods Pro. That would mean bringing production up to 2 million units per month. That is a lot of AirPods. and then, further evidence that this is all working for Apple is that Apple now holds a commanding lead in the wearables market thanks to AirPods and the Apple Watch. These are latest numbers from IDC for Q3 of 2019. They indicate that Apple's wearable shipments were up 200% year over year at 29.5 million units, meaning that Apple now commands a 35% share of the wearables industry. And again, that's on the backs of two products, AirPods and Apple Watch. And of course, we know Apple may be extending further into wearables with their AR headset sometime in 2022. So that will likely only increase that lead in the industry. So AirPods doing very, very well. I still absolutely love mine. I find it so hard to believe that I really like the AirPods Pro even more than my AirPods. I knew they were going to be nicer, but they're like a game changer. The noise cancellation is really, really nice. Transparency mode works really well. They just are fabulous, and I absolutely love them. So I can understand why Apple is doing so well with AirPods. But I'd love to get your take on it. What do you think about AirPods maybe coming in the next iPhone? Do you have a pair? Do you want a pair? Do you think it's crazy? They are expensive. That's the other thing, right? They're not cheap. But more and more, I'm seeing them everywhere. So I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on AirPods. Shoot me an email. Send me an audio comment. Maccast@gmail.com. Ming-Chi Kuo seems to think that Apple plans on making the move to mini LED displays in 2020, at least in a couple products. He says that Apple is planning 4 to 6 products over the next 2 to 3 years that will contain mini LED displays. And he thinks they're going to start with a new high-end 12.9-inch iPad Pro with an A14X chip sometime in the third quarter, of 2020. He also thinks that Apple could put a mini LED display in a refreshed 16-inch MacBook Pro by the fourth quarter of the same year, and says the displays could use as many as 10,200 micron LEDs. That's compared to, say, the 576 LEDs, standard LEDs, that Apple has in Apple's Pro Display XDR. So a much higher density of these things. And in case you're wondering, you know, why mini LED? What's the advantage of those? Well, it would allow Apple to have thinner and lighter designs that are more power efficient, something that Apple is always striving for, especially in their portable products like the iPad and the MacBook. And along with that, you get a lot of the advantages that you would typically need, say, like an OLED display for. The wide color gamut performance, the higher contrast ratio and dynamic range, also providing local dimming areas so you can have those deep, deep blacks. Plus, mini LEDs are not prone to burn-in like OLED. So this is some really great next-gen technology. Beyond that, there is also micro LED, and it's possible that Apple is looking to bring that technology to a future Apple Watch screen. it's much harder to do than the mini LED. Mini LED is hard enough in and of itself, and that's where Apple's going to have the challenge, is in manufacturing and yields, something that anytime they switch to a new display technology, if you've been listening to the MacCast for any amount of time, you probably already know. But that's always the big challenge, right? It costs more to make them. They're more difficult to make in terms of the yield. And with micro LED, it's even harder. So they'll probably start with a much smaller display. We've been hearing Apple's working on the technology. No word on when we might see it. Maybe 2021, 2022? Probably not in 2020. But we might see mini LED with a couple products, at least if you believe Ming-Chi Kuo. As you probably know, Apple has been on a pretty much yearly release cycle for the iPhone for years and years and years now. Almost always in the fall, we get new models of iPhone, and Apple is expected to keep that normal fall release schedule in 2020, launching between 4 to 5 models in the fall. But a JP Morgan analyst thinks that that could change sometime in 2021 with Apple releasing models throughout the year. The theory is that Apple could help better compete with other smartphone makers who release updated models throughout the year if they followed suit. I think they could easily make that transition, probably starting with staggering to a consumer release and then a pro model release, with possibly a consumer update coming in the spring and the pro models still coming in the fall. As a matter of fact, in 2021, Ming-Chi Kuo also believes that Apple may move to dump the Lightning port, at least in some of their models, but not like you would think for USB-C. He's saying that they could go with no port at all on those future devices. He also thinks that in 2021, Apple will create an iPhone SE 2 Plus with a full screen design, no Face ID, but Touch ID not at the chin of the display, but actually integrated into the side button. So a little bit of change there, still using a Touch ID sensor, but getting it off the front so that you can have a full edge-to-edge, full screen design on that smaller iPhone. We still need to see if Apple's going to have that iPhone SE 2 or iPhone 9 or whatever they're going to call it in 2020. As far as what Kuo thinks 2020 will look like, he says we will see 5 different iPhone models, a 4.7-inch single rear camera design with an LCD screen and Touch ID, a 5.4-inch and a 6.1-inch OLED model with a dual-lens camera system, and a 6.1-inch and 6.7-inch OLED Pro model with triple-lens rear camera systems. So that's what he thinks the lineup's going to look like in the fall. All of those models, he says, will have 5G connectivity. The Pro version also could feature the rumored 3D time-of-flight sensor system on the rear lens assembly that would enhance and better support things like virtual reality and augmented reality. We also, in iPhone news, have a strange rumor from Mac Attakara, who says that the iPhone SE 2 could be simply called the iPhone 9. When Apple released the iPhone 10, they jumped over the iPhone 9. They had iPhone 8 and iPhone 10. So I guess they could turn around and pick up that model name. It would make more sense for the design that we've been hearing about, which is basically it's going to be an updated iPhone 8 with new internals, same size, same form factor. So not really as much an SE 2 as it would be an update to the iPhone 8. They say it's expected that that possibly could be introduced in the first quarter of 2020, with pricing likely starting around $399 US for a device with 64 gigabytes of storage. So that would be a great entry-level price point model for Apple, and I have a feeling they'd sell a lot of them. So imagine an iPhone 8 with the latest processors and that price point and storage. Yeah, I think that would be a very popular model. Something Apple also might be able to do with the 2020 model iPhone is increase the battery storage a little bit. And they're going to do that, supposedly, by switching to a 50% smaller battery protection model. This information comes from the Korean website, The Elec. The battery protection module is the thing in the iPhone that keeps it from overcharging or over-discharging your battery, which could cause damage. And the new smaller module supposedly would allow for a slight increase in battery capacity with that little bit of extra space. So typically we've seen that when Apple does get space inside the iPhone, either doing a new motherboard design or moving to smaller components, yeah, that usually gets consumed by the battery, because that's typically what more people want than anything else, is longer battery life, and this would be a way to achieve that. And then finally, in iPhone news, Rosenblatt securities analysts are pointing out something that happens around this time every year, but they're pointing it out as maybe a little bit of a concern or a warning about iPhone sales. They're saying that Apple is planning to cut iPhone production, saying that interest in 4G phones is waning, and that a lot of folks are anticipating the 2020 release of 5G iPhones, so Apple is going to compensate by cutting production. This time, they're cutting by 25% for the December through March quarters, and that actually is a smaller cut than Apple has taken in past years. So that says to me that iPhone sales are still going pretty well, and Apple is planning to continue to sell through a significant number of iPhones even in the coming quarters. We've seen them cut as much as 50% in production. And why I say this happens around this time every year is that Apple has the new release in the fall. They massively ramp up production because they know they're going to have very, very high demand. And that level of production is just not sustainable for the long-term sales cycle of iPhones. So they do an adjustment, they slow it down, and we usually hear about that this time of year, toward the end of the year. So this is nothing unusual, nothing to be concerned about, and is more just status quo. So that's the latest in iPhone news, at least in regards to what we're expecting in terms of new devices or future devices. Now, talking about your current device, if you have an iPhone 11 Pro, there was a little bit of a hubbub this week about privacy, specifically related to the GPS module. Security researcher Brian Krebs noticed that the iPhone 11 Pro would continue to collect GPS data for some applications and some system services, even when the location services setting for those apps was turned off, set to never. And he kind of tweeted about it and called it out, and also noted that the same issue or the same sort of security leak didn't seem to show up on his iPhone 8. So it was a little bit curious that this was something that was on new devices. Now, you could disable the tracking or disable the GPS by completely disabling location services in the settings, and that would stop all activity even on the iPhone 11 Pro. Apple did confirm that certain services continue to collect location data even when the user has selected never for an individual system service or app. That only sort of pushed the panic a little bit further, and Apple did have to come back and later clarify and provide some more details that ultimately explained why this phenomenon was happening and why it was only appearing on newer devices. Basically, it's due to international regulatory requirements that require that the new ultra-wideband chip and technology that's in the iPhone 11 Pros be turned off in certain locations. So they were using that location data on device to automatically toggle off the ultra wideband technology. They said, quote, iOS uses location services to determine if the iPhone is in these prohibited locations in order to disable ultra-wideband, and comply with regulations. That was what an Apple spokesperson told TechCrunch. They also iterated and stressed that the use of location data is kept to the device to control that functionality. None of that data or information is actually sent to Apple. And then they further said that they plan to add a toggle in a future iOS update that will totally block location services on the iPhone's 11. And I would assume that would also then disable the ultra wideband technology at the same time, because obviously they wouldn't have access to the geolocation data to do that automatically. And while we're on the topic of tracking, something that is having a big impact on advertisers, apparently, is a feature in Safari that disables their ability to actually track you. In a report from The Information, they say that Safari's intelligent tracking prevention feature is working to thwart advertisers in some demographics, and they are not happy about it. Basically, what's happening is it's driving down the prices for ads targeting Safari users by as much as 60%. And you might be thinking, well, isn't that a good thing, Adam? If the price goes down, I'm going to see more ads. No, actually what's happening is the pricing is going down because they're trying to convince advertisers to buy ads on Safari devices, or they can't charge advertisers as much really for ads on Safari devices because you can't be targeted, because you can't be tracked with this new feature. So big win for Apple, not such great news for advertisers, but great for our privacy. Apple seems to have a lot of love for singer-songwriter Billie Eilish. Not only has she performed at Apple's special events recently, now they have awarded her with 3 Apple Music Awards: Artist of the Year, Songwriter of the Year, along with her brother, and Most Streamed Song of the Year. Apple awarded the new awards, which consist of a custom-designed 12-inch disc of Apple silicon chips, kind of to replicate like a platinum album or a gold album. They're actually really, really cool looking, and gave out their first set of Apple Music Awards this year, and Billie Eilish got 3 of them. Not only that, according to Billboard, Apple has paid $25 million for the rights to a Billie Eilish documentary that they plan to air on Apple TV+. The film supposedly follows Eilish after the release of her debut album, When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? And like I said, that will be coming out sometime on Apple TV+. And speaking of Apple TV+, this week also, one of Apple's shows, The Morning Show, got some nominations for the upcoming award season. They received 3 Golden Globe nominations. That includes a Best Drama Series nomination, along with nominations for both Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon for Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series Drama. Apple was quick to point out that this is the first time a streaming service has earned Golden Globe nominations in their launch year. And that is true. Apple just launched the TV service in November, and already they are picking up some award nominations, which is great. Now, to be fair, Netflix kind of pioneered this idea of doing your own original streaming content. Amazon followed suit, and it did take them a couple years to build up their programs to get awards, but that's because it had never been done before, and it took a while to even get recognized. Apple is moving into an ecosystem where this is a thing now, and so when you create great programming, obviously using great talent and great actors, you are going to likely get recognized for that, but still a really big honor. The Morning Show also received 3 Screen Actors Guild Award nominations, 2 for Outstanding Performance by a Male Actor in a Drama Series for Steve Carell and Billy Crudup, and 1 for Jennifer Aniston for Outstanding Performance by a Female Actor in a Drama Series. I'm frankly surprised that the morning show is the only show that got some nominations. I think C and For All Mankind are really great programs, and I'm really enjoying those. I guess now, though, I'm going to have to knuckle down and probably start watching the morning show, because I actually have been hearing great things about it. I hear it's a little bit slow to get started, but once you're into it, it's supposedly great. So I will probably check that out, maybe in advance of this upcoming award season. And then finally in the news for this week, an upcoming Apple product, we're not really sure which one, could get a new kind of aluminum, carbon-free aluminum. It's something that was developed in collaboration with two of the world's largest aluminum producers and Apple, Alcoa and Rio Tinto. They worked together to form a company called Elesis and co-developed and patented this new technology. Basically, the aluminum is produced in Pittsburgh. It is the first to deviate from the 130-year-old process of producing aluminum that uses carbon. By removing carbon from the process when fully developed and implemented, it will eliminate direct greenhouse gas emissions from the traditional aluminum smelting process, helping the environment. Alcoa and Rio Tinto hope to commercialize and license the carbon-free smelting process beginning in 2024, but Apple is going to be the first to benefit as early as next year, it looks like. Now, again, we don't know what product they're going to put this in. I think we can probably imagine maybe iPhone casings, maybe MacBook Pro casings, any place where they use aluminum, which is a lot of places. And we know Apple is pretty aggressive about their environmental efforts, so this is a great next step in that direction. As far as producing the aluminum in Pittsburgh, there are also plans to open up further manufacturing facilities in Quebec, Canada, sometime in the second half of 2020. So some great new environmental news, and nice to see Apple continuing to drive that forward. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Masterclass. Masterclass offers online classes that let you learn from the best. They offer exclusive access to online classes taught by masters of their craft. And here is the great news, because you know I love Masterclass. I've been taking all kinds of courses on there. For a limited time right now, one Masterclass All Access Pass is going to get you another All Access Pass to give away as a gift. They're doing a buy one, get one. So when you sign up, you can also give the gift of Masterclass to someone else. And one of my favorite things about Masterclass is just the amazing depth and variety of the courses that are taught on there. So there's going to be something for you. There's going to be something for your friends, your family, and it does make a really great gift. My daughter has been taking a number of the classes. She's an aspiring writer, and they have great courses from masters in writing, folks like Neil Gaiman, which is something I was super excited about. I've been taking his classes. I'm not even a writer, and I am learning all sorts of things about storytelling and how to become a better podcaster. So I'm using it in that way. They also have courses on science and technology and business, cooking, a lot of cooking courses. So if you want to up your cooking game in the kitchen, this is a great way to do that. Or maybe you have a chef in your life, someone you know who enjoys cooking, they would love learning. So get it for you for maybe the technology stuff, maybe game development with, say, Will Wright, guy who designed The Sims. That's a great class too. I've been taking that one and learning a lot of great things about prototyping and design from him. And then give another one to a friend or person in your family who maybe wants to do cooking stuff. And what's great about it is because of that variety, I'm finding I get into one course or one sort of thing and then discover something else. And you're only able to do that if you have the All Access Pass. I think it's an amazing value. It's a great investment in learning. And now is a great time to take advantage of it. They have over 65 wide-ranging class offerings. There really is something for everyone. And like I said, for a limited time, when you buy one annual Masterclass All Access Pass for yourself, you get another one to gift for free. Just go to masterclass.com/maccast to get started with this limited time offer, and it is limited, so do it now, and that'll let you buy one all access pass and get one free to gift at masterclass.com/maccast. And a huge thank you to them for their support of the show. There has been an ongoing conversation across several of the past episodes of the Maccast about getting, finding, and using older Mac OS installers. And I wish we didn't have to have this big a conversation surrounding this, but it's come up because Apple has made it darn difficult to be able to get an older version of their operating systems. And I kind of get why they do it, but I think they need to recognize that there's a lot of folks out there with older Macs that are still running that maybe they need to grab and install, say Mountain Lion, or maybe even Lion. In my case, that is an actual reality because I have an old Mac Mini that is stuck at iOS, at Mac OS rather, 10.6. And luckily, I still have the original discs, so I'm okay. But if I needed to find a copy of it, I would have a really hard time. And so we've been going back and forth. I've given you a couple tips and tricks on where you can find installers. There's a support page on Apple's website. And I think today we're going to have the pinnacle, the last sort of method for downloading this stuff, because, and I call it the pinnacle because we've reached the ultimate nerddom, the terminal. Raffi, a Maccast listener, sent me a link to an article, and I'll link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, over at 512 Pixels. That's Stephen Hackett's site, I believe. And the article talks about the terminal command software update. That's the thing that basically drives the software updates on your Mac. And you can actually do a lot of the stuff with software update from the terminal, including things like getting a list of software that needs to be updated or updating the software. But one of the features that's in there is the ability to download or get the latest Mac OS installers. And the way you do it is with some flags on the software update command. Again, I'll have information on this in the show notes at maccast.com, or better yet, you can go read the article over on 512 Pixels. But essentially, you run the software update command, you pass the flag fetch full installer, and that will download the latest Mac OS installer for your machine. So currently, that would be Mac OS Catalina, and the latest version of it, 15.3, right? Which we just talked about earlier in the show. But you can also pass a second sub flag to that fetch full installer command, full installer version, and then specify a version number, and it will download that version of Mac OS. Now you need to be specific. You need to add the full version number. So for example, 10.15.2. if that was what you wanted. So you would run software update --fetch full installer --full installer version 10.13.6, for example. And then you would get Mac OS 10.13.6 and have the installer locally that then you could use, burn a USB drive, whatever you want to do, or copy it to a USB drive and burn. I talked about a USB drive like a CD-ROM. Oh, man, I'm getting old. But anyway, you get the point. You can download it and get different versions. Now, I did notice that it does seem to only go as far back as Mac OS Sierra. Is that right? 10.13 is Sierra or High Sierra. So you still can't get those older versions, but at least here's another method to go out and find an installer. And also in that same article, they have a link, a bunch of this information, or if you just want more information on the software update command, there is a great Jamf article in there, and you can read through that, and you can see full details on the Software Update Command along with all of its flags. Of course, if you want to stay nerdy and you want to stay in the terminal, you can also just run the man page command in the terminal to get the information on that installer. And yep, here at the bottom of my show notes, I have the information. It only goes as far back, at least for the OS installers, as High Sierra. So 10.13.6 is High Sierra, and that's the oldest version you'll be able to find on there. I received an email from Maccaster Robin this week, and he has a situation where he has several, and I think a lot of us are in this situation, which is why I wanted to talk about this, but he has several different external hard drives from different eras that he's using for different things. All of those drives have different connectors. Maybe you got some FireWire ones, you probably got some Thunderbolt ones, maybe USB 2, USB 3, that sort of thing. And he has also maxed out the ports for connecting external drives on his iMac. So he was asking for ways to possibly optimize his external storage. When I mentioned that at the top of the show, you might have thought I meant a different kind of optimizing. Nope, I just mean how to have sort of efficient, clean external storage hooked up to your Mac and maybe free up some ports. So he says he's looking for a different solution than what he currently has and asks, quote, is it better to get one high capacity hard drive or three smaller ones? And as far as how he's using that storage currently, the external storage is used for extra storage for Time Machine. He also mentioned he has a Backblaze backup for offsite backup. So nice job on the backup regimen, Robin. But the question, you know, is it better to get one high capacity hard drive or three smaller ones? I generally don't like having just one large storage volume that then maybe you partition up or you just put multiple stuff on. And the reason I don't like that is because you still have a single point of failure if you only have one drive. So say you take one drive, you partition it just in half, you do something simple. You do one half for Time Machine and you do one half for your external storage. That's great and it's going to work just fine. But if that hard drive goes south, you've lost both your Time Machine and your external storage. So personally, I prefer just to have multiple drives connected. I use USB powered 2.5-inch portable drives. You, of course, could use bigger desktop drives if you want. I just like the fact of having less cables, the one, you know, cable to plug in. And you might go, well, if I have three smaller drives, though, I'm going to use up a lot more USB ports or Thunderbolt ports or whatever it might be. And for that, I would say just get a hub. I use a hub connected to my MacBook Pro. I use a Satechi 7-port USB 3 hub. It also has conveniently three power ports on it, so I can plug in my wireless charger for my iPhone. I have that plugged in there. I can plug in other devices just for charging, and it's great. And I want to say it costs $30 or $40, but I have 6 different devices plugged into that right now. So I have one port free. I might need a bigger hub at some point. And if you have a newer Mac, something with USB-C or something with Thunderbolt, there's great Thunderbolt USB-C hubs you can get. And I really think that's the way to go. That way you can have like a single cable running into your Mac. You're only using up one port. And then you have all of your external drives and things hanging off of that. Just make sure if you are getting a hub that you get a higher quality hub. I've seen some of the cheaper hubs and things like that where you lose reliability. I even still from time to time have some issues with the Satechi that I have, but overall it's been great and working for me for years. So that's how I would handle it. Again, I'm just one person. This is just one person in the community's opinion. I want to get as many opinions in here as are out there. So if you have some great solutions for managing external storage, keeping it clean, maybe reducing the number of devices that are connected, and you want to share that information, shoot us an email or better yet, an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. And I hope this helps you out, Robin. Now I want to bring up a something that has been going on my iPhone, and actually something that I received a couple of emails about this past week. And it is, I don't want to go as far as saying an annoying pop-up, but yeah, in some ways it kind of is annoying. And maybe that's why I want to have this conversation with you. It's in iOS 13, there is a new privacy feature that alerts you periodically to any apps that you have running on your device that are using your location in the background. And if you've upgraded to iOS 13 and you're running it, I can almost guarantee you you've seen this dialogue. It pops up and it says, this app, and it'll just have the name of the app, so let's just say it says Maps, has been using your location in the background. Do you want to continue allowing this? And then you have a couple different buttons under that with different options. You can say change to only while using the app. You can say nope, yep, I want it to always use location in the background. Or there's also an option for doing it just once, which means, hey, that's okay, let it use my location right now, but after that, then no more. And the problem is that even if you say or set the setting to always, and maybe even go into the privacy settings area and say, yes, this app is allowed to always access my location. For example, that's how I have Carrot, my weather app, set up. I want it to be able to use location in the background because I want to get up-to-date information on the weather. I want to be able to get notified when, say, there's a storm coming in. And in order for that to work, the app needs to have always-on access to the GPS. And so, yeah, I want it to be able to do that. I want it to be able to track me. Oh, and by the way, that dialogue that comes up, it's pretty cool. It does show you all of the places on a map where that application was pinging your location, you know, back to its servers or whatever it might be. So you can kind of make this informed decision, which is great. But the problem is that when you even set the app to say, yes, I want to always allow this app to use my location in the background, you still will get these pop-ups at some point, right? And I don't know what triggers them, whether it's a software update or a certain period of time has gone by. According to Apple's documentation, it sounds like it's a certain period of time. So you give it permission, you say, yeah, I get it. This app is running in the background. Go ahead. Let's allow it to always do that. You'll be fine for a week or two, and then boom, it'll pop up again, and you're having to do it all over again. Now, from Apple's perspective, they say, yes, this is exactly how it's supposed to work. It's a security feature. I think the idea is that you might forget that that app is using location in the background, and they just want to resurface that and say, yep, are you still okay with this app running in the background and, you know, reporting all your locations that you see here out to the developer or to whoever? And that's nice, but again, I want a setting or a way to be able to say, all right, I get it. This app is using my location in the background. You don't need to tell me about it anymore. I'm fully aware, and stop bothering me. And we don't have that option right now. And so a number of people wrote in to say, hey, this is really annoying. I think this is a bug. It's actually not a bug. It is a feature, at least from all the research that I've done on this. So now I'm curious, how do the rest of you feel about it? I shared my opinion. I shared some thoughts from a couple people in our community, but what do you think? Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, for the show for this week, I received a question via email from Jeremy. And Jeremy was wondering if it was possible to recover old deleted messages from the Messages app using Time Machine on the Mac. And I honestly have to tell you, I didn't know if this was possible or not. I did a little poking around, and the first thing that I had to figure out, Jeremy, was where are messages stored on your Mac? So if you're using the messaging app on your Mac, where do those things go? And it turns out inside your home folder and the library folder, there's simply a folder called Messages, and that has all the information and data. As a matter of fact, if you look in there, there's a folder called Archive that actually stores the messages in little .iChat files. So you can peruse through that folder. Basically, inside that folder, you have a bunch of folders that are sorted by or separated by date. And that is the date of the messages you received on that date, which is a little bit weird because if you have like a message thread that's running over several days, what you'll have is separate little iChat files in each one of those folders. So you can open those. You can actually go in and open those iChat files right inside the Messages app, and you can see the messages in there. So the good news for you is that that means, yes, you should be able to use Time Machine, and I actually verified this on my Mac, to go back and get older deleted messages out of Time Machine. Basically, you just browse to that folder, Home Folder Library Messages, activate Time Machine, and then you can scroll back in time, find the messages inside that archive folder that you're looking for, and then open those up. Now, the one thing you can't do from there is recover those back into the Messages app. I didn't find any way to do that. Maybe there's a trick, but I did a little poking around, and I didn't find anything that was immediately obvious. Now, another thing that you might be trying to get to when you're trying to recover old deleted messages, and very likely is what you're trying to get to, is maybe the attachments, photos that were sent, something like that. The attachments are also in that library messages location, but they are all inside these very cryptic hashed folder names, and actually drilling down and finding the actual attachment files or image files is going to be pretty difficult. It's not going to be something that is easily done, but you can do it. And again, you could go through those folders via Time Machine and get all of that stuff back. Now, I was looking at this going, this is kind of cumbersome. It's not really an easy thing to do, but if you have Time Machine running, it's a way, right? It's a possibility. Another possibility, if you're doing backups of your iOS devices on your Mac, is to use your iOS backups. And this will only work if you're doing backups or have done backups through iTunes, not through iCloud. You could be using both, but if you're only using iCloud backup, you're not going to have access to these files locally. But if you have done iTunes backups, there is a folder on your Mac, again, in the home folder, in the library folder, inside application support, inside a folder called Mobile Sync, and inside a folder called Backup, you will have all of your iOS backups for your iOS devices, if, again, you've made backups locally from iTunes or the new music app or however it might be. But if you have those, you'll have those available. And again, unfortunately, when you look in that folder, you will see that the backups are stored inside these cryptically named folders. So you won't really know which thing is which backup, or there's no real easy way to tell. But you can activate Time Machine inside this folder, go in and restore or recover those old backups, and then use a tool like iMazing to go in and actually open up those backups and extract or view the messages. Now, once again, you're not going to be able to put these back into the Messages app, but at least you can get at the raw message data that is in there, and you can kind of go back in time and recover stuff. Now, the really nice thing about doing this method versus the other one is that iMazing will also export any attachments in your messages. So you can get at those photos, documents, whatever you've been sharing inside the Messages app, and actually export those attachments, and they make it quick and easy. So that's how you would do it, Jeremy, at least a couple different ways that I am aware of. There might be some other ways that community members are aware of. If you do have a solution for this, maybe a third-party app, maybe a tool that you use, send us your emails, your recommendations, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on social media, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.